everybody. It's Becky Brown with your October Club New Life Collective. You know, it's fall. There's lots of things that are changing. The leaves are falling, changing colors, and we're heading into winter in some parts of the country anyway. But, you know, I'm always reminded of how fast the years go by. It seems like, now I'm going to sound really old here, but it just seems like yesterday I was tuning into New Life Live for the very first time. Some of you have been listening for a very long time, and you remember those days when you had to wait in the car before you went into any appointment you might have because you wanted to hear the answer to the question that was being asked. I love the legacy that New Life Live has, and New Life Ministries has helped so many people over these 36 plus years. And as we continue to grow and make changes and all of those kind of things, you can know that the message is still the same. We want to see true truth. We want to see redemptive relationships. And we are so excited to see the transformation in so many people's lives. One such change that has just come about, you know that Steve has been on sabbatical most of this year. He's had some health challenges, but also just trying to regroup after 36 plus years of ministry. And he has made the decision to retire from his normal duties here at New Life. He loves what we are doing. He is so excited to see how God is going to continue to take us into the future and will always be real close to us. And I just want to let you know, our Club New Life family is near and dear to our hearts. And I just wanted you to be one of the first to know. And we're so grateful for Steve's wisdom and his insight. You know, I think about his legacy and all of the lives that have been changed because of Steve's vision and his willingness to try something new and different. And I just hope that you'll continue to help us water that legacy, the New Life tree, to see new lives changed. We've got so many people who are needing help and hope, and New Life wants to be there for them for the future. We're so grateful for Steve, and we look forward to many more years of New Life. Our first teaching this month is from Dr. Alice Benton on social media pressure facing moms. Let's listen in.
Hi, I'm Dr. Alice Benton. I'm one of the co-hosts on New Life Live, and we're going to be talking about moms and social media. I've done the majority of my research on parenting and on children's use of screen, but I took a look at some research done with about 2,000 moms looking at how their scrolling on social media affects how they feel about themselves. So consider with me, does your scrolling tend to lift you up? Does it motivate and inspire you? I find social media can be very enriching, and I get a lot of ideas of things I want to try with my family, with my children, off of social media. I just made a Thai shrimp soup the other day. It turned out beautifully. I made a lemon bread. That didn't turn out so well, but it was a good experiment, and I will probably try it again. I love being inspired by cooking and parenting ideas on screen. But it's also easy to feel like I'm not doing enough because of what I see other people doing with their kids that I don't get to. So about 65% of moms report that they do use social media, and many feel worse about themselves as moms because they're not measuring up to what they see on their screens. In fact, we moms who scroll, because I'm one of them, we are 4 times more likely to feel bad about ourselves. It's not uncommon for moms to report that they feel like a bad mom about half the time. 156 times per year was about the average number for moms who feel bad about themselves. Half the time! That's a heavy load to carry for moms who are already so busy caring for the souls and bodies of their little kiddos. So let's look at some of the ways that social media can negatively impact our self-esteem as moms. For those of us who follow momfluencers, which are those folks on social media who mainly post about parenting, and again, my props to them. They inspire me. They set a high standard that has some days helped me to raise my game a little bit more. But Many of us moms can admit that we know what we see on the highlight reels is unrealistic for us to live out on a regular basis. We know it's unrealistic, and yet we still beat ourselves up for not living by it. There are a couple of areas in which moms tend to report feeling inadequate. We feel like we don't cook enough, especially with organic food. Feel like our bodies aren't good enough. We don't keep our houses clean enough. We don't wake up early enough, and we don't exercise enough. Now, admittedly, all those are good areas for growth and improvement. But if our expectations aren't grounded in reality, and if we're not receiving grace for the areas in which we're falling short, it is a setup for that self-dislike or even self-hatred to start accumulating. Personally, there were a couple of other areas where I felt like I really needed to do more than I was doing or was capable of doing. I think moms have a pressure, internal and somewhat external, to bounce back into athletic shape very quickly after having children. Oh, and we moms know it is not that easy. In my community of influence on screen and even in my personal community, as a young mom, there was such a pressure to just nurse and to not use any supplemental formula for our children, and to do so for 2 years. There was an expectation that there was no screen use whatsoever for our children under 2 years of age. It is a recommendation by the Academy of Pediatrics, and yet it's a tough, sometimes impossible recommendation to live by. Something that has always been eye-catching to me are the color-coordinated crafts or toys and toy bins that some moms are able to at least produce for the video that they do and the photos that they post. And I felt that expectation. My house should look like that. Let me tell you, my house never looks like that, and it probably never will. There seems to be this expectation that our children should always be clean and should have the latest fashionable outfits. I sent my son off to school the other day, and as he walked out the door and into the bright, direct sunlight, I realized he had his shorts on from the day before. We'd had barbecued ribs the night before. He had barbecue sauce splattered all over those shorts. We hadn't noticed and changed him before he'd gone to bed, and there was no time to change him then. So I sent him to school with those shorts on. Doing the best we can over here, folks, and sometimes we're not all clean and in fashionable outfits. Many moms also feel that they have to do all these kind of stay-at-home mom tasks, but they're supposed to be earning an income as well. Now, some of these things are good standards that perhaps we should strive for. But if we're only looking at the influencers and their highlight reels and the photos they post, and we're not checking in with other messy, down-to-earth moms, then those expectations can be so unrealistic. And so my recommendation is that we need to invest in relationships with other women, with a sisterhood, with peers, with whom we can admit, I yelled at my kid the other day and I so regret it. I let my child watch more screen time than is recommended because I really needed a sanity break and we couldn't pay for a babysitter and the screen did a great job babysitting them for that time. We need to be able to admit that as moms with young kids, the sexual intimacy with our husbands may not be top priority for a while, and it can be an area where we might feel like we're falling short, and we need to be able to commiserate with other moms of how tough it is to still invest in that area of marriage. By sharing our real life struggles and shortcomings, we learn that we're not alone. We learn that these struggles are all common, and we receive love and grace through our sisters and through God, channeled through our sisters. Now, our two top priorities that God tells us to keep in mind, loving God well and loving others well. And those two priorities are a lot more important than keeping a clean house or eating organic foods or having things color coordinated. But if we're not looking at God's priorities for us as frequently as we're looking at social media priorities for us, we're going to get skewed. And so we should be making sure that we're getting time in the Word and time with other messy believers so that we can both be a mess and be kind of accepting of it while still striving for more and striving for better, but with the right people setting those standards and helping us to set our standards. It took a while for me as a young mom to become okay with needing naps as frequently as I do to keep my sanity. And in my family of origin growing up, naps didn't seem acceptable to me. It seemed like laziness. But I've come to realize as a young mom that they're a necessity, and I'm a kinder, nicer mom when I can let myself do that. Some tasks, like cleaning, have to be delayed until later. Just the other day, I had just swept and mopped the floors, and then we went out to the beach and had a fabulous time and came home, and when my little guy took his shoes off, sand spilled all over the floor, my well-mopped, well-swept floor. Oh, it was pretty frustrating. And I couldn't clean it up. I didn't have the time. I didn't have the energy. There were other tasks that needed me, so I had to leave my floor sandy. Some tasks can wait till later. Love has to be our top priority, not cleanliness. We can also ask our family for cheerleading, and I need to do this frequently. Will you tell me, what am I doing well? In fact, I just asked my husband that this morning, and he gave me examples of things I'm doing that are loving my family well. And so, in summary, let's be cautious about who's setting the standards for us of how we should be living. If it's purely social media, we're going to be off. Hopefully, God is setting the standards. We're grounding the way we strive for those standards with other normal, messy moms who struggle every day too, just like I do and just like you do. And then we can ask for that feedback, because sometimes we can only see the ways that we're falling short. We can't see the ways we're doing really well at life, and we need to hear that cheerleading from people who love us. If you could use some more good, kind, caring people in your life, maybe even a counselor, a coach, or a group to help you put these things into practice, you can call us here at 1-800-NEW-LIFE.
We have two calls highlighting parenting. The first is Lisa, who finds it difficult to compassionately respond to her depressed daughter, and then Jordan yearns not to follow in the footsteps of his abusive parents.
Lisa, what's going on today?
I am feeling bad about how I am responding to my daughter and her mental instability. Like, she has all the signs of and is saying that she is depressed and has all those signs. So I believe her, but I just can't empathize with her. I really can't. I go at her like I'm angry with her, and I'm looking for ways to be more compassionate, because I don't want to make it worse, obviously.
Yeah.
But I don't understand it either, because I know her life. I know that I've sacrificed from the day her and her brother were born. I know that we've given them way too much and spoiled them. So I can't grasp why, how, or how she has gotten to this point. And therefore, I know that I'm not as compassionate or supportive as I probably need to be for her to get through it.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'm looking for help.
Well, I love that you called in for that, because we talked about blind spots, and you're not being blind to the fact that your reaction to your daughter, it can be more damaging than helpful, and you don't like it in you. And that is great, great self-awareness. So thank you so much. That's being a good mom right there. So
thank you.
Let me ask you this one quick question before I hand this over to Sherry. What does her depression mean about you? What's the meaning you give it about yourself? She's depressed because I am fill in the blank.
That I am not a good mother, that I failed her and her brother. You know, we believe we being my husband and I, were raised, sort of raised with tough love, you know, and so that's how I've been responding to her. But we lost both of us lost our parents when we were in our teens. We're now in our 50s, and it's like, you know, my prayer has always been to be what she needed, to be that resource I didn't have or we didn't have when we grew up. So that, and I've given her everything, but I think in that I've failed her.
Okay, so just stay there for a moment. I'm going to go one level deeper. I want you to stay in your body. I want you to notice your body between your chin and your belly button, as if there's a straight line there. When that belief inside of you that says, I have failed as a mom, shows up, where in your body do you feel that?
In my heart and my gut.
Okay. Heart and gut. Okay, good. On a scale of 0 to 10, 10 being like the most intense you would ever feel it, how much do you feel that today?
I would say a 7 or 8. And oh. Talking about it is probably at its highest, talking about it.
Yeah, yeah. And as a side note, Lisa, now you see why people can be resistant to therapy, because when you talk about it, it brings it up. But we're going to mm-hmm. help move you through that. So I'm going to hand this over to Sherry. Sherry, what do you think here?
So let me, before we go, what's your question?
How can I respond to her instead of trying to push her through? I guess, how can I hold her hand through what she's going through? How can I be more compassionate or more understanding when I'm not really understanding or compassionate to her situation?
Perfect.
I'm more angry.
Yeah.
I'm like, how can you be there when all that we've done for you?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, good.
Perfect.
Sherry, where do we go from here?
Now, when you said to Chris, he did a great job of just kind of unzipping the issue, which was, because I failed her as a mom. How do you hear that in your head? You told us what you think is the problem. How do you hear that? What's the negative belief about yourself in light of your daughter's depression? Like an I am statement. Or I have.
I have failed.
I failed. I have failed. Mm-hmm. Now, I love the Apostle Paul. He is the first mind coach that we ever had in the Bible, because he says what? It matters what we think. Mm-hmm. So I have failed. Now, what I want you to do is I want you to do a 180 degree turnaround. I talk about this in my book, 180 degree turnaround. If the negative belief is I have failed, what's the opposite? What would you like to believe about yourself if you did a 180-degree turn? What's the very opposite?
That I have succeeded, that I am a good mom.
Okay. Right. Mm-hmm. But can we always... Okay, so I'm a good mom, and I've succeeded, right, in raising mm-hmm. our daughter. Mm-hmm. Now, let me tweak it a little bit. What happens when our kids are struggling? Is it harder to say I've succeeded?
Yes.
Okay.
Definitely.
But you're a good mom. You provided a lot for her, right? Loved her.
Mm-hmm.
So what if we tweaked it just a little bit and you had the opposite be, I'm a good mom. I did the best I could.
Mm.
What do you think about that?
I do think that's true.
Okay.
I really did.
But I do think that's true. But what's blocking you? What's in the way of you owning that belief 100%?
How she is feeling, how she's now depressed. And like, so I must have done something wrong, you know, not done something or done something wrong or whatever. So
right. But you know what you're doing? You're making yourself the reason for her depression. You're in the way.
Mm-hmm.
You're actually in the way right now of being able to sit with your daughter, because your shame, it's shame. This is a mm-hmm. shame pop-up. I have failed is shame. Shame is the culprit of all chaos.
Mm.
It is the culprit mm-hmm. of all chaos. And when we believe something, that's why the Apostle Paul said, hey, you know, it matters what we think. If I am in the middle of that shame pop up and I feel like, well, it is me. I must have done something wrong. My daughter's depressed.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know that someone's depression can be a genetic thing?
Yes.
Okay. Is there anybody in your history or your husband's family of history that struggled with depression?
His mother.
Okay.
Yes.
All right. Now, we don't have to make your daughter his mother, right? But that very genetic component of somebody's brain. When we're born into this world, you know what's so weird is it's almost like Christmas cookies. We don't think about, we look at the picture of our baby and we see them as they grow up and we say, oh, she's got your ears, my eyes, our hands, you know, she's got an innie belly button, I have an outie, whatever. And we look at the outside of our kids, but you know, we don't consider that organs inside are also a part of what we get in the goo of being created. Now, she could have gotten that genetic component.
And
so you might be taking on the shame of somebody else's depression struggle that could be genetic. And that shame and your belief that you're a failure might be keeping you from just being present with her. You're fighting your own shame instead of realizing you're a good mom, you did the best you could, and your daughter's struggling with depression. Now, it could be genetic.
Well, yeah.
Or it could be Amy, the amygdala. Mm-hmm. When we have events in our life, the amygdala, we have events that have been painful. Could be a breakup. Mm-hmm. It could be something that happened that you don't know about, happened with your daughter that she still has not brought forward. It could be a trauma event, and that wires in a negative belief that I'm not safe, I'm not in control, I'm not capable, I'm not good enough. Who knows what it is? Mm-hmm. Those negative shame beliefs feed depression. And that's why therapy can be really a lovely intervention, or psychotropic medications or supplements.
Yeah.
There's so many things to treat depression, but your ability to sit with her means you've got to get out of the way and lay down your shame and start believing the truth.
Yeah. I want to address a false belief that is very common that I think sometimes is perpetuated by our own profession. I call it therapeutic legalism, you know, rules that no one can abide by or beliefs no one could follow or live out and punished for it. What happens that behind this, Lisa, is that if I'm a good parent, my child won't struggle or suffer. Right? I can save them from the condition of being human. Nope. You're not God. We're not God. And so the idea that we have is that we think we're in control of something that we were never fundamentally in control of. Now, we hate seeing our children suffer. That's absolutely true. And we, as parents, it's instinctual to do everything we can to get them out of their suffering. But now what's happened is that because the belief of you can save your children from suffering, and if they suffer, you have failed. So now there is no tolerance for your child's suffering. Because it's no longer about them. It's about you failing. So what you're doing, Sherry talked about this in a previous show about codependency. Mm-hmm. Codependency is about fixing somebody else's problem so that I feel better.
Wow. Okay.
Right. Mm-hmm. So instead, it's like, if I can keep cultivating that these two things can be absolutely true at the same time, because they are true at the same time, I am a good mom and my,
I did the best I could.
I did the best I could. And my daughter struggles with depression.
Now, what does that feel like as Chris is walking you into that? To hold both of those at the same time. Both hands, your palms up, and you're holding both of those concepts. What does that feel like?
When you said it, you first said both of those things being true. I'm a good mom. I did all I could. And that was sort of the happy. But then when you said, and my daughter struggles with depression, that was kind of the letdown in my mind. You know what I mean? Like that just took me right back down again.
Okay. So that just tells us that you need to get into some deep therapeutic work. What Sherry is landing on with, I have failed, that this failure message, and you told us that it's sitting in your heart and your gut, goes back a long ways and is really deep. And it's interfering in your life in some really painful ways. But friend, let me give you hope. It doesn't have to be like that.
Okay. Thank you.
All right.
Thank you.
In fact, Sherry and I did a little bit of riffing off of each other in a little bit of what's called an EMDR protocol. You get into some good EMDR therapy.
It stands for eye movement desensitization and reprocessing.
Yeah, it can help you through this. So, Lisa, we're going to send you a copy of Take Your Life Back. And we're also going to, I want you to stay on the line because we want to get you connected to a good therapist, maybe an EMDR therapist in your area. You go to work on rooting out what's in your heart and your gut, and you're going to find freedom. I would even say sign up for an emotional freedom workshop. Do whatever you can, and there will be freedom and deeper connection on the other side of that. Lisa, thank you so much for calling in. We're going to go to Jordan listening in Saginaw, Michigan on Sirius XM.
I've been going through a lot of mental problems. So I'm not saying like crazy or nothing like that, but from the past and my upbringing, my father, he did time in the service, his Navy SEAL, whatnot, but he came home with a lot of PTSD.
Yes.
And me and my brothers were just horribly treated wrong,
Yeah.
It was just a horrible, all the way up to when I was 15 and I had to be an adult, I had a kid at a young age. Was taught the wrong things, dude. And my grandfather, he he's a deacon at a church. I do have, I do have, God in my life, But I'm having trouble letting go of how I was treated, and all that, And it only comes with like my kids, they do the same mistakes I did when I was younger. But I used to get beat. I don't do that to them, I don't treat my kids like that. But when I get done, I talk to them about it. And the situation's good with me and my son. I go in my room and I just beat myself up. And it you get what I'm saying?
It's I do. Amazing. I do get what you're saying.
Every day.
So Jordan, you continue to do to yourself kind of where your father left off.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it's still going through it. I'm still going through it. I got six kids. I raised them good. They've never seen a day how I was raised, they never witnessed, never felt any type of bad emotions of how I was raised. They don't know nothing about it.
Yeah.
My wife doesn't even know.
Yeah.
My wife knows a little, but she doesn't know. And I communicate with her and, and my father, he's still in my life. I tried to sit him down, talk to him like, man, how I feel, but he's constantly borrowing money from me, not paying me back, treating me like I'm nothing.
Yeah.
I'm nothing.
So Jordan, let's do this, man, because I have a really good idea where to take you here, but I want to make sure that I'm living where you're at. So what's the question for us today? How can we help you?
What are the steps I could do to either just cancel them out of my life or how to approach that to them or just do it. They're my toxins in my life.
It's an essential question. What do I do with the pain of the past that keeps showing up today?
Yes.
All right. Jim, what do you think?
I've got a phrase for you, Jordan, and I think you're awesome, by the way. Before freedom comes pain. And you may have to look at some of the pain of your relationship with your dad. And sometimes you go talk to a counselor, you talk to a coach, any of us. I mean, you sound like a really sharp person. And so that means that sharp people are willing to go get the help they need to get to, they'll go to the coach, they'll go to the counselor and kind of work through some of this stuff. But, the Bible says something, these guys go to it, but I want you to hear this. The Bible says you inherit the sins of a previous generation to the third and fourth generation. Hey, you know what, dude? You are the transitional generation for that family because you aren't doing what your father did to you. And so you need to celebrate the fact that although you still have this pain, you aren't, putting that pain on those kids of yours. They haven't seen that. So, you are a guy who can make progress. You'd be the guy I'd want in my office hanging out with because you're willing to make those changes. Mm-hmm. But to do it, you may have to have some, like I said, before freedom comes pain. Remember this, you're part of the transitional generation, and that's so key. Mm-hmm. You're changing the trajectory of a family that, you didn't get. But you're making a difference. Right. So keep on keeping on, but keep getting the help that you need.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's really important, Jordan. I'm so glad you called. And you've been trying to kind of keep a lid on this, and you're already recognizing that it kind of leaks out, right? Mm-hmm. I think it's important to be in that growth process so that you will continue to show your kids something different. So you're doing it for you, and you're doing it for them. So that's really important. So I think to get into some therapy, mm-hmm. I also would recommend my book, Forgiving Our Fathers and Mothers.
Yes.
And I think you have to start to not expect anything from your dad. You have to get to a place where you can kind of love him with a little bit of detachment, as we were talking about earlier, and see him as a hurting person, but not need from him, because you're not going to get what you have needed from him.
And I think that's really, really important, Jill, because Jordan, I feel for you, man. I had a dad who also carried PTSD from war and carried deep addictions.
Yeah.
And though wasn't violent because he wasn't there. Mm. But there's this weird thing that happens because dad is inside of us, man. Mm-hmm. Our dads live inside of us, and that's why we have daddy issues, and that's why we got to work through them. And join me. I'm a card carrying member since 1975. So in my daddy issues, what I had to learn how to do was this. I had to learn how to grieve. Mm-hmm. But it was a weird grief. I had to learn how to grieve the dad that I got.
Yeah.
But I had to learn how to grieve the dad I would never get.
Yep.
I understand that. But it's to the point, I haven't cried in 7 years. Not shed a tear about it. I'm emotionless about things. You know? And I'm starting to repeat his way of thinking.
Jordan, that's it, man. There is this line I think is pretty brilliant. You know, it's the pain that we do not transform, we transmit.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. The spiritual writer Richard Rohr wrote that, you know, the pain that we do not transform, we transmit. So as Jim was guiding you, we've got to go in. I hate to say it, but to heal out a wound, we got to touch the pain. Mm-hmm. So getting into a good therapist. A good trauma therapist that helps you work through that. It starts rooting out
with
that pain.
With a male therapist.
Yeah, I think a male therapist would be huge on that. Mm-hmm. Because there's going to be two things that we're going to do with that pain. We're either going to medicate it or act it out.
Mm-hmm.
And when we medicate it, now we're in addiction.
Right.
When we act it out, we're just causing harm. And we also act in, too. We act in towards ourselves, and you told me you're doing that. So the key is that a good healing process really helps us move through it so that we no longer carry pain and fear that has to be medicated or acted out.
So we can help you find someone to meet with. But then I think you've got to let your wife into this process, too. The fact that you've not told her things.
Yeah.
She's got to be part of it. Right? She's your support team.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And to
trust
her. I
guess she already knows.
Probably.
Well, she's
getting it.
She both knows and she feels it.
Yeah.
And it'll produce intimacy for you with her. Connection. Intimacy, connection.
Absolutely. So we're going to send you a copy of Jill's book, Forgiving Our Fathers and Mothers. I'm also going to do this. It's not coming up until October, but you are also going to get a free registration to our online conference, our Life Recovery Conference. And that just helps you continue in this recovery from your trauma process. But before that, let's get you connected to a therapist who can really help root this out and free you from the pain of your father issues.
Our next teaching, Mark Cameron addresses how to process grief. Then we weigh in on a call from Cindy, who seeks guidance in responding to an alcohol and marijuana addicted husband.
Well, and yeah, your story is horrific, and Alice put it aptly when she said it's impossible. It's too much for a person to forgive by themselves. I think what I would say for you is learning to grieve first. I think you know, and part of grief is anger, and you may have to be able to be angry first before you can get to the sadness and the loss. And a type of therapy that you might want to try, I know you're a hypnotherapist, but you might want to try something called EMDR, which stands for eye movement desensitization reprocessing. And there's a lot of research about EMDR, and it's different from traditional therapy because in EMDR you're reliving the memory in a safe place, but you allow your brain to take you with prompts from the therapist, and they use something called bilateral stimulation, whether that might be like alternate buzzing in your hands or your eyes moving back and forth. And what happens is, as you kind of re-experience that memory, it desensitizes you to the emotional impact of it. And learning to be able to do that first may help you be able to grieve. And then, like Alice is saying, you know, having the decision to forgive before you get to the emotion to forgive, and recognizing that forgiveness really is for yourself. It's for you to be free from the bitterness and the hatred and the hurt of this, of what people did to you, because it's truly awful what you've gone through.
We're going to talk to Cindy, listening in Louisville, Kentucky, on YouTube.
Thank you all for all that you all do, and may the Lord bless you all.
Oh, thank you so much. Well, we're very glad to have you on today. Can you tell us what is happening with you and how we can help?
I'm stuck waiting for real life, and it never begins. And then my husband needs help, and I can't help him. Mm. And he won't get help.
What does he need help with?
Alcohol and marijuana.
How long have you guys been married?
40 years.
40 years. Wow. And Cindy, how long has this been a problem in your marriage?
I would say most of it.
Most of it? Yeah.
Is he aware that it's a problem? Like, would he say he has a problem with alcohol and marijuana use?
No, he definitely does not. It's my problem. And it's because of my dad, you know, how I grew up that, it's my problem.
Yeah.
So did you grow up with an alcoholic father?
Yeah.
And so he believes that you're just overreacting to his drug and alcohol uses.
Is he a high functioning user? Does he maintain a job? Does he?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. He said he goes to work every day, and he works, he says.
What's your relationship with him like?
Bitterness and resentment.
Is the bitterness and resentment all around this alcohol and marijuana use for 40 years?
I think so. Yeah.
Are you the one that's bitter and resentful?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Well, Cindy, let me ask you a question. What does a typical day in your husband's life look like?
He works. He comes home. He might say something. He may not. Maybe 10 words all night. Maybe not. And then he'll drink. And then...
And what does he drink?
Mostly shots and then beer.
So like shots of whiskey, shots of...
Yeah, whiskey.
Whiskey, okay. And then beer.
Yeah.
And this is a daily routine?
Yes, but he says it's not every day.
Okay.
But it is.
But it is every day. Well, that's a good alcoholic,
What's a day in your life look like? What are you doing?
I retired to watch my grandchildren, and he says, that I don't work, that he works, and then, I don't do anything.
But that's okay. Tell me, though, what does your day look like? Like, he goes to work and comes home and drinks and maybe says 10 words and goes to sleep. What are you doing?
Nothing.
So you get up in the morning and you just sit there and...
I watch the kids from 7 to 6 if I have them.
That's not nothing.
That's not nothing.
I'm sad you call that nothing. That's a hard working job.
That's why I pushed back. I'm like, no. So you are doing something. So, and I don't mean the question to challenge your staying at home with the grandkids. I want to know, when he comes in the door, do you say anything to him? He has 10 words for you. What's your welcome? What is it like for you after the kids go home?
Well, I start walking on eggshells and I try to, get the kids to come around him and, the little ones, and just talk to him and that. And then, will usually go, you know, try to stay out of his way.
And I think most of the time, most of these days, you're feeling pretty sad, pretty scared, and like you have no power to change any of this. Is that right?
If he didn't have the drinks, what would you expect your time with him in the evening to be like?
We might sit and watch TV, you know, but really there's no conversation. And, you know, I've tried to ask him, I say, you know, I just want conversation.
Yeah. So, Cindy, So, Cindy, let me jump in. Everything that you're telling me right now, telling us, tells us that you are living deep in an addictive system.
Yes.
Right? Walking on eggshells, disconnected. Yeah. And you, one of the telltale signs, this is for all of us out there, one of the telltale signs that you are living with an addict or you are living around addiction is you have the addicted person under-functioning and everyone else over-functioning. You're trying to even manage a relationship with the grandchildren with him.
And the children.
And the children, right? So as long as you over-function for him, you keep him drinking. And you're not responsible for that. I just want to say it keeps it all going.
It protects his drinking.
That I'm making him, you know, I'm making him look like the jerk, making him look bad.
Yeah, yeah. So that's all all the defense mechanisms. There's denial. No, it's not a problem. There's minimization. It's not that big of a deal. There's justification. I work hard. And there's projection. You're the problem, not me. So all of the telltale signs of addiction are right there. So you are not relating to a person. You are relating to an addiction. And an addiction that you are powerless against. He is too, but you are powerless against. So all of the management you're trying to do around it is not working. And therefore, you said it well, repeating our words, you're sitting around waiting for your real life to begin. Mm-hmm. So, guys, how do we get her into her real life?
Well, Cindy, I can just sense that mantle of fear that you live under. And it's a scary situation you are in. So you're right to be so concerned about what your husband is doing and is not doing. And we want to get you empowered. We want to reconnect you with courage and with assertiveness. You may never have had or felt those things growing up with an alcoholic parent. So there was a setup here already in your life. But Cindy, getting into your own counseling, having a medical evaluation for your anxiety to find out if medication would be a help to you, and then getting into the rooms of Al-Anon, because there you will learn that there are a lot of things the family members of an addict can do to keep themselves safe and protected and to invite their addicted family member in to help as well. Now, he's already said no, he's not interested, but it just leaves a whole world of action steps that you can take, Cindy, to take better care of yourself.
Yes, Cindy, I think you're wanting him to stop doing something that he thinks he needs to survive. And so you're not going to win. You're just not.
No.
So stop that fight and turn
I said I was going to change him when we got married.
That's a clear symptom of an adult child of an alcoholic. So
you're not alone in that.
Yeah,
belief.
You're not alone. I get it. I get it. Yeah.
But you're not. You haven't. In 40 years, you've seen that you haven't changed him. Now, it's not to say people can't change. People do. We get married and we evolve. We become different people. You have to do that work for yourself. It's time for you to evolve, become the person you want to be, live the life you want to live. And so take your eyes off of him and kind of think about the plank in your eye versus the speck in his eye. I know that speck looks like a plank, but it's not yours to manage, as you've seen over the 40 years. Yours is your speck. And if you turn that energy on yourself, you will begin to live the life you want to live. And you'll have to maybe leave him behind.
Yeah.
But he doesn't want me to get the help.
Yes.
He doesn't.
No,
he's going to
because,
keep gaslighting
hey, if,
you.
It, yes. If you get help, his covers are pulled. The addiction's in trouble.
But you get help without it having to be anything about him.
Yeah.
Your help is not about him. And if he tries to make it about him, you can say, I offered you help. I wanted to do work with you. This is about me.
Yeah, this is what I'm going to do. So please.
It's hard to step back because I don't know what he's going to do.
Well,
don't worry about it.
Don't worry about it.
Are you afraid he's going to harm you?
No, I don't think so.
Okay. If you're worried about him leaving or over drinking or doing any other strange thing to or about himself, there's nothing you can do about it anyway.
Well,
I'm almost like him to be gone better.
For sure. And so, Cindy, that's the first move. Get into Al-Anon. These are people who are in a similar situation for you that are finding solutions. And we're going to send you a life recovery Bible that helps you get into your work as well as take your life back. I'm going to send you two resources. And we need lots and lots of resources because you've lived in this situation for a long time. It may take a little bit to live outside of it and to live beyond it. And as we said, getting your life to begin in front of you. And so this is a reminder for all of us. It's not just the addict whose life is hijacked to the addiction. It's everyone who's connected to the addict whose life gets hijacked by the addiction.
And you, at that point, you want so desperately for them to get better so you can have your life back. And in actuality, you have to release them to their own situation and you take your life back.
And that's why I tell families, and myself included, may not be fair, but we all need recovery now. Mm-hmm. We all have to get into our work.
Next, we have a call from Ray, who's puzzled about enjoying his alone introvert time, but feeling like an extrovert in public. Following Ray's call will be our final teaching this month. J.J. West and Doug Barnes will shed light on men's defensive objections to addressing sexual integrity.
Ray in Atlanta, Georgia, listening on Sirius XM.
I got an interesting question and dilemma, or it's not really a dilemma. It's just maybe you can help explain it. I'm a very much of an introvert, but I can be like an extrovert, especially around people. But I enjoy my time alone immensely, and it's something where my wife can't understand it, and we've been married for 35 years. And are you guys familiar, like, with Freddie Freeman, the first baseman for the Dodgers, and what just happened with his son?
Yeah, I just saw a thing on it on ESPN about how his son had that medical condition that became life-threatening. It's like a neurological degenerative thing, real weird anomaly where his body started shutting down.
Exactly. So I'm watching the ball game the other night on the East Coast here, but it's a West Coast game, and he's just coming up. He gets a standing ovation, and I just get tears in my eyes, and I seem to be able to experience life through other people's emotions, whether it's on TV or it's in person, and I always lean towards the people with, on the fringe. I could be in a restaurant and I could see a busboy there and then everybody's ignoring him. I'll give him a tip,
Yeah.
And things like that nature and the aloneness. And, as a Christian, I do believe our relationship is above and beyond, without doubt, with Jesus Christ, the Father and the Holy Spirit. And I gain such strength from that in this aloneness and this time that I have alone. As I'm 66 and a half, and I just retired couple years ago. Mm-hmm. And I just look at it as something that's it presents an interesting situation. I don't know if you guys can explain this, because my childhood was very similar. I had very little social interaction as far as going out or at school. I was very shy. Mm-hmm. I walked home alone. All these kind of different things, but yet I can be very loving towards other people and feel these emotions and stuff. So I don't know where that comes from in that way.
Well, and what's the question for us?
Well, the question is, in that situation, is it possible to be an introvert and an extrovert at the same time?
Yes, is the easy answer to that. So I'll answer that question because it's the easy one, and I'm going to have my wonderful co-host answer the more complicated and difficult ones. But I want to give an awareness, but it's a question. It's a Bible question, Ray. I don't know if you'll be able to answer it. I don't want too much pressure on it. But in the beginning of Genesis chapter 1 and 2, where God says all of this creation is good, in fact, it's very good, he said there is one thing that's not good. Do you know what that one thing is?
Well, I can imagine that the biggest thing I get from other people is you can't be alone.
That's it. Okay?
Bingo,
you nailed it.
Ray,
it's not good for man to be alone. And we know that aloneness comes with a lot of suffering, right, Mark?
Yeah. So to jump in where you started here, Chris, it is possible to be in between. Mm-hmm. Introversion, extroversion are on a spectrum. And there's a term called an ambivert, meaning that somebody is kind of in the middle of those two.
Mm-hmm.
Now, here's what I want to kind of tease out a little bit. There's a difference between being shy here, Ray, and being an introvert. Introversion means that somebody just regains their energy from being by themselves, and they lose energy when they're around other people. It doesn't necessarily mean that they don't, that they're afraid of other people. Now, shyness often comes from a social anxiety. And that's fear-based, and usually that's linked to something that's happened in a person's life. So those two are a little bit different. The other thing I want to point out that I think may be true for you is that sensitivity is also on a spectrum. And people who are on the high end of the spectrum, there's this term called a highly sensitive person. And what you're describing here, Ray, where you can see other people and feel their pain even through a television screen, or you can notice the busboy on the other end of the restaurant and nobody's paying attention to them. People who are highly sensitive pick up on those things in other people and they feel them deeply. And so I wonder if, you know, you are somewhat in the middle, maybe on the introversion, extroversion scale, and you're an ambivert, but I think you're likely a highly sensitive person. And that's where this is kind of confusing you between, am I an extrovert, but then I feel deeply for others.
And Mark, what are the benefits of being a highly sensitive person?
Well, it's estimated that there's probably about 20 to 25% of people who are highly sensitive.
Yeah.
And this is just God's stamp on you. It's not something that you've chosen. You are just this way. And so it's important that you don't use that as an excuse to shy away from people. Because like you were saying here, Chris, it's not good for man to be alone. So people who are HSPs need to recognize this about themselves, but not use it to keep themselves withdrawn from others.
Yeah.
But also to know this part about yourself, to know that you might be more drawn in to helping others at times when maybe you shouldn't be helping others, or feeling more pain when really it's
so.
It's,
that
it's
sounds
about
like you got to really work on boundaries there.
Yeah, exactly. And you've just got to understand these things about yourself. The more aware you can be about yourself, the better equipped you can be to be able to help others. And it's also important to let people in your life who are close to you know this about you, so that they can understand what's going on, because they may label you as too sensitive, and you're not too sensitive. It's just something that's going on the inside, and that's the way you are. You can't help it.
You said your wife doesn't understand, Ray. And so I also want you to consider if it might feel safer to have empathic emotions for other people you're not connected with emotionally, but it might not feel safe to let your guard down with your wife, which could be connected to your parents. If your parents struggle to see you and connect to your heart, it makes it hard for us to do that in our most intimate relationships.
And that can be hard for boys, because in our society, it's socially acceptable for a female to have sensitivity. But for boys, it's not so much, and they can be laughed at, and they can feel like they're pushed to the edge. Is that what might have happened to you, Ray? Was that your experience as a kid? Were you sensitive and felt like you were on the outside with the other boys?
Oh, yeah. I mean, oh, for sure. What happened, though, is I would say later, like in like middle school, when people's personalities start to get bigger, you know, and I didn't go to any kind of dances. I didn't even kiss my first girl till I was 23, and I married her. And I didn't even know how people had babies till I was 19. And so, but on the aloneness end, this is what I don't understand, is that when you feel like you're, you know, in society and everything, they don't get you in a way, and then you feel this, or you feel this thing from other people where they feel like they're detached from society, that's where the Holy Spirit just comes in and just fills you up, and you walk like Jesus. And, you know, Jesus, of anything, he was always concerned mm-hmm. about the least people.
Mm, for sure.
And
that's
and it's just, I guess, it's just overwhelming. And it's beautiful in a way. So.
Well, and Ray, you're speaking just to that. Is that a person that carries those sensitivities to the others in the world around them also carry a higher capacity for love, a higher capacity for compassion, and a higher capacity oftentimes to serve?
Oh, yes, I agree, because to me, it's the thing about serving is so much important instead of, you know, then, you know, the relationship thing is where I have a problem with, is because then people want to see you more and, you know, and all that stuff. And then you've got to, it's almost, and that's where the boundaries come in.
Absolutely.
And that's what I don't understand too, you know.
Well, here's the other thing, Ray, is that what is happening inside of you when you see them, it has already happened inside of you. Does that make sense?
No, go ahead and explain that one.
When you recognize that outsider, as Mark was alluding to in your life, that is a part of you that is also feeling the hurt.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. I see.
That's right. Because you already told us really clearly about you growing up. No one was tuned in to Ray. No one was paying attention to Ray. And so you're feeling and carrying that loneliness. And when you see it in others, it triggers that similar feeling inside of you.
Okay, I understand. I see that. But where does, but Jesus, the Holy Spirit comes in you. And
for sure.
Fills you, and it gives you strength to overcome that human connection where you're saying, gosh, your Father in heaven has given you so much love.
For sure. And I believe wholeheartedly in that. But I'm also going to ask you another biblical question.
Okay.
In the New Testament, when the body of Christ is referred to, what's it referring to?
It's referring to all believers together.
Other people. Yes, other people. Right. So we see this in the greatest commandment, that the resource that God is pointing us to is, of course, himself. But it's also like saying, hey, but also one of the major resources I've given you all is each other. And,
right.
and I think that there's a longing in you for deeper connection that isn't being met.
Ray, I'm a fellow introvert. And I think part of our sanctification process is the willingness to keep getting out of our comfort zone, to risk going deep with other people, not just recognizing those other outliers and giving the tip or tearing up when you see the baseball game, but letting people like your wife and other men in your church community get to know who you are. Now, I would bet you experienced hurt through that time in middle school. And so you may not feel compelled to let people really get to know you. And it might not come naturally to you. I prefer being alone myself, Ray. I'm much more comfortable by myself. But in order to fully live out the Christian life, we need to be known and know other people so we can get to know their deeper needs as well, to keep meeting each other's needs. And so I want to challenge you to even consider trying out counseling, because sometimes we have to start with the safety of a professional relationship and letting a professional get to know us so we can then transfer that process to our spouse or to other men in the community.
Well, and I also wonder here, Ray, too, if you were sheltered a bit here, maybe by your mom, because you talked about not even really knowing how babies were formed until you were, I think you said, 19 years old.
Right.
Did you have a parent who sheltered you?
Well, I had I don't know so much he sheltered, because my sister, who was 2 years younger than me, she's just the opposite of me. Mm-hmm. But I think what happened is, for some reason, I feel closer to women than I do men, because the way, in playing the sports I did and everything, and they would, you know, talk about women mm-hmm. and everything, it was just, I would walk away from it. And mm-hmm. So I always feel closer to women than I do men for some reason.
Well, but that makes sense, because women generally communicate on a higher emotional level than men in general. And so, yeah, when you're, like you said, you notice this more when you got out of middle school, you got into middle school, right? When it's less socially acceptable for a boy to cry when they fall over and hurt themselves. Mm-hmm. And then you see these boys who start to jockey for attention, right? Yeah. And and manhood. And so, yeah, it makes sense that if you are a highly sensitive person, that you would connect more with females.
Well, and so you just recommend me to see a counselor? I tried to see a counselor here, with my wife.
Yes, but here's what I would also recommend, because I think there is still a lonely boy inside of you walking around.
Yeah, I agree.
And so I would recommend some individual, but you're set up perfectly for the emotional freedom workshop, where you're going to be able to do a little bit deeper dive into your own story, into your own process, as well as get in a group with other men that allows you to process it at a deeper level. So as much as that can sound intimidating, or maybe it sounds exciting, I don't know. But Ray, the Emotional Freedom Workshop, again, is designed specifically for you and what you're going through and how to get to that next level. And the more that we can connect with ourselves and understand our own story and what's going on inside of us, the easier it is to connect with the people around us. And the more that we have a higher level of acceptance for ourselves and what's going on inside, the easier it is to accept other people and connect with them. And so I want to really, really encourage you in that way to attend the Emotional Freedom Workshop.
And there's other emotionally intelligent men out there too here, Ray, and other men who are in touch with their emotions. And I think probably some of your growth is learning how to connect with other men who on that level too.
Yeah. So, Ray, thank you so much for calling in today. We're going to send you the Emotional Freedom Workbook.
Hi, I'm JJ West.
I'm Doug Barnes.
And we want to spend a little bit of time talking about some of the objections that guys have to attending the Everyman's Battle Workshop. One of the first objections we hear is the cost. It's expensive. I don't know how I'm going to pay for this workshop. So you've heard that before, right, Doug?
I have, especially when I worked for New Life Ministries. We would get those calls all the time.
Yeah.
And we would talk about the workshop. We would talk all of the components of the workshop. This is going to be what you get from it. This is going to be how it shows up. And guys would say, well, that's a little bit too much for me. And that's when we really start to talk about the benefits versus the cost.
Right. Right.
Because the benefit of going to the workshop is getting a plan. Mm-hmm. Okay, that's what we walk away with. But we discuss things that have to do with the wounds and the shame and the boundaries and the triggers and a lot of the components of our addiction.
Learning how to connect to others.
Learning how to connect.
Yeah.
Learning how to connect.
And so there has to be a shift, right? There has to be a shift from, instead of looking at it as a cost, oh, it's going to cost me this much for the registration fee. It's going to cost me this much to get to the workshop if I have to fly there. Instead of thinking about it as a cost, thinking about it as an investment. We will spend money on continuing ed for our professional development. We'll spend money on our hobbies and the things that we enjoy.
Right.
Will we spend money on our own healing and the healing of our marriages? So it's an investment. I'm learning how to live life fully. I'm learning how to do authentic connection with others. I'm learning how to build authentic intimacy with my wife. It's a worthwhile investment to put me on a path toward healing.
But, you know, one of the questions that comes up maybe indirectly is, am I worth that? Is my marriage worth that?
Right.
And I have to make that decision that investment in not only my marriage but in my particular healing, what is it that I'm struggling with that I really need delivered from?
Yeah.
And so it's more of an investment in the long-term legacy of my marriage, my kids, my church, I mean, anything that I become involved in, because as I get to a place of better healing and better functioning, let's say, as a husband and a father and a teacher
as a
and
real
a coach,
boy.
As a real guy, right? Every relationship that I touch is improved. And so as my healing progresses, so does the healing of all the other relationships that I come in contact with.
Yes, exactly.
Right? And so it's not just about the one-time hit. It's about a long-term investment that pays off dividends long into the future. But we don't realize that in the beginning because we're in the pain of what that behavior is really dictating to us.
There's so many people who will pay a career coach to help them interview better and find the right fit for them. And that pays off over time because working with a career coach is expensive. But over time, if it puts you on the path to better and better jobs, it pays off over time. We're talking about doing that same thing, but relationally speaking. The other objection, or one of the other objections, not like there's only two, but one of the other main objections that comes up is the investment in time, because we're talking about Friday, Saturday, Sunday of the workshop. We're talking about travel to and from. And some guys will say, man, I don't know if I can take that much time off of work or family or softball schedule or whatever, right?
And so how is this 3 days going to change the trajectory of my life? Because that's sometimes where I can't put a cost value to that, but that's because I don't understand what it's actually going to give me.
And I would say what we don't understand is that it's an intensive. I'm spending 3 days just focused on looking at my brokenness, finding out where did that start for me. I'm looking at the way that I approach relationships. I'm looking at my the shame messages that I believed in. And it's all happening in this really 48-hour period when we break it down. It's just over 48 hours that we're together, but it's a Friday, Saturday, and half a day on Sunday. It's intense, and so it's actually a really efficient use of time. It's like I say, it's like doing like 2 months of counseling in a weekend, because I'm covering a variety of topics, and I'm getting away from a lot of the distractions that make it difficult for me to really make progress sometimes in my day-to-day life.
And that's an important point, getting rid of distractions. There are so many things vying for our attention and our time. And when you come to this workshop, what we're doing is we're building on session after session after session. It builds. We get momentum. And we get momentum from Friday into Saturday and into Sunday. I've done this for 18 years, and it never fails that it seems to exponentially speed up. And so the time that I would say it would take, it speeds up so fast as the workshop continues. And so the time that we would use is for the investment in me, but it's bigger than just me. It's the investment in my marriage. My relationship with my wife, my kids, my church, everybody that happens.
My neighbor, my brothers,
And the guys that are around me. And that's what it's hard to understand when you have.
Until you've experienced it.
Until you've experienced it.
Until you've experienced it, you don't know what it's like to spend a weekend being like emotionally naked and bonding to the point where, I mean, there are guys who 10, 12, 15 years later are still getting together, their EMB group are still getting together because of the relationships that they built at the at the workshop.
I got a 12th year notification 2.5 weeks ago. Guys had they went to an EMB in Atlanta, and every year those five guys, 12 years later, are still getting together once a year to connect the way that they did. They're like best friends. It's pretty cool. It's pretty cool.
It's a worthwhile investment.
It is.
It's a worthwhile investment of your money. It's a worthwhile investment of your time. So if you need information about the Everyman's Battle Workshop, you've got some questions you need answered, call 1-800-NEW-LIFE or go to newlife.com/EMB.
Lastly, we love to keep you in the know on what is going on in New Life. Help us spread the word to your friends and family about upcoming events and intensives. We have our Life Recovery Conference, October 5th, online. Intimacy and Marriage will be in Dallas, October 25th through 27th. Every Man's Battle will be November 1st through 3rd in Orange County, California, and our Restore Conference will be November 1st through 3rd in Washington, D.C. November 9th, we have our Club New Life Zoom, and Chris Williams is going to share with us. We're going to do it on a Saturday morning, 8 a.m. Pacific Time and 11 a.m. Eastern Time Zone. We'll send you the Zoom link. Thank you so much, Club New Life family. We're so grateful for you. Stay in touch with us. We'd love to hear from you. And maybe share New Life with somebody today. It could be the best thing for their new life.